struck me as interesting but a little fishy. And what I thought I would do is talk about that today. And I think, though I think that backward causation is not a particularly good explanation for non-local correlations by itself, I think that these models suggest something else. And I do think that there are some interesting lessons to be learned from them. So let me just give you a quick overview. Bell's theorem is commonly understood to show that EPR correlations are not explainable via a local hidden variable theory. But Bell's theorem assumes that the initial state of the particles is independent of the final detector settings.
You could say yes.
I just mean it in the most generic Bell's theorem sort of way. Local means Bell locality means the conjunction of parameter independence and outcome independence. Those are the Shimoni terms. It means factorizability. I don't mean this at all in an all contentious way. And I think what I'm talking about will make the difference in these kinds of theories quite clear. So it's been proposed that this independence assumption, okay, that the initial state of the particles, I'll picture up there in a minute, is independent of the final settings of what properties of the particles you choose to measure. It's been proposed that this might be undermined if we had backward causation, and thereby allowing a
local hidden variable model after all. So a theory which did not, in which parameter independence and outcome independence held, but nonetheless the quantum correlations were reproduced. So in this talk I'm going to show that there's no backward causation model which yields the desired correlations. That's actually maybe a bit of an overstatement since I can't possibly review everything, every model that calls itself a backward causation model. But there are other physical scenarios yielding non-trivial, non-local correlations which violate the independence assumption. And I will present two, and I think they're kind of interesting. So this is my little picture of the EPR setup. We have two particles labeled L and R, which potentially have different states indicated by the different colors. Two detectors, D, which I've called DL and DR. I think these may be a little small to read. If so, I'm sorry. The states of the detectors are indicated by the colors, so it's possible for the detector setting to change in flight. And these are not going to play a huge role in our discussion, but these are represent the outcomes of the detection of the particles here. Different colors, different outcomes. This is gray and black. Maybe spin up, spin down, and whatever in the blue direction, and spin down in the red direction. You can think of it like that. Did I have this up already? I did. No, it's because I went up. This is my first Beamer talk, so watch for many. Yes, thank you. Good so far. Okay, so Bell's theorem is said to rule out local hidden variables. In particular, for our purposes, though, it involves the assumption that the initial state of the particles, lambda, which I've written as a pair, L0, R0, is uncorrelated with the detector settings, in that it assumes, for instance, this is a little chunk of out of the CHSH inequality. The key thing here is that this is the correlation between measurements of on the left and B on the right, and this is the correlation between A on the left and B prime on the right. And the assumption here is that the rho of lambda is common to both of these, so that rho are
that the probability of a given initial state is independent of which properties you choose to measure. It's only that, because of that, that it's appropriate to take this row outside of this correlation. This is the product of the expectation value of a measurement of A and a measurement of B, and this is the product of expectation value of measurement of A and a measurement of B prime. So the idea is you're taking an initial state randomly out of a given pool without knowing about what's going to be measured, and then calculating the correlations between different outcomes at different detector settings. So if the probability of a given lambda is going to be a function of the detector settings, DL and DR, then, for instance, rho sub AB need not be equal to rho sub AB prime. Okay, and you would write this correlation like this, something like this. This D lambda fell off the end. But you would have a different density, different probability density for this and for this, and I think as a consequence, you're not going to be able to derive the CHSH inequality. Okay? Now, so this is the assumption that's usually made, okay? That the initial state is impervious, can't know about what's going to be measured in the future. Okay, because it hasn't been determined yet. Sometimes this is motivated by the appeal to the fact that we can freely choose the detector settings after the particles have been released from the source, okay, which seems intuitively plausible. And then there's a suggestion around that that relativity doesn't require this, since the detectors are causally connectable to the emission, to the event which corresponds to the emission of the particles. It may be a kind of backward causation which gives rise to correlations. So what I'm going to show is that backward causation models aren't backward models at all, but models which postulate non-local constraints on data at a given time. And sometimes these are referred to as conspiracy theories. Yes?
I'm not clear on what is special about saying the detectors are causally connectable to the emission of the particles. Of course they are, because the particles go from emission to detection.
Right.
So you're saying that some these models have some information that travels independently of the particles, but still causal?
I think that's part of the problem. That is the intuition, I think, is that somehow the I don't think that these models are really do the job, and I think you're moving in the direction of the problem with models. But
okay.
And I think it'll become clear as I go.
So I'm going to finish up. I think this is probably the positive. Yes, maybe we'll go with. We can do it now. Update. How many seconds do I have before it does it? Okay. So quick review of relativity. Relativistic theories are characterized by compact domains of dependence and influence. This is the domain of dependence of an event E is the area on or in, depending on the theory, the past light cone. So given data here, this is fully determined. And similarly, for domain of influence, given some slice from the future light cone, the event E is fully determined. Now, actually, the words domain of influence suggest a certain time asymmetry. That's what they suggest, is if you do something here, you can influence this area. This is it's true up to a point. I mean, the problem is, of course, that you can do something here, but something else could come in from over here to spoil whatever it is you're trying to do. For our purposes, though, these domain of influence and domain of dependence are just the sort of the future and past versions of relativistic determination. Okay, so that you can think of the data up here as influencing this, as determining this, rather, just as you can think of the data down here as determining this. Both equally good.
You're using okay. Different definitions than I'm used to in causal analysis that you see in relativity. Are you saying that the points that you showed were respectively the domain of influence and the domain of dependence of those black blobs, or was it the other way around?
The other way around, yeah. The domain of dependence of E is the past light cone, and the domain of influence of E is the future.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's the intersection with the fixed type of surface.
Yes, right.
That we find.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was the black part.
The black.
Right. Okay, so here's our slightly enhanced EPR setup. The idea is simply that this initial state here
is supposed to be correlated with the final detector setting as a consequence of a, quote, causal influence from the future. And the so what we have, this is looking at the future domain of influence of this, is, say, this region right here. So that's a region down here would do, too, and this can create difficulties for this kind of analysis. But I'm going to give the people who work on this the benefit of the doubt, and I'm going to look at a domain of influence which is coincides with these detection events. So what we have is the position, the state of the detector at T equals 1, and the state of the particle at L, at particle L, T equals 1, state of particle R at the same time, and the state of the detector on the right at that time. So, yes?
Just
said.
If you dropped this phrase as a consequence of a causal influence from the future, nothing would change.
Right. Yeah, thanks, sir.
So in other words, the idea is that it was a correlation.
Well, that's a more general question. Yeah, in fact, I was.
Well, it's a little bit more subtle than that. So let me keep going. At least the way I'm thinking about this.
Yeah, I mean, what's lurking here is the question: can you define a direction of causation beyond just a correlation between two events? There'll be some. You have to put something into the theory that will let you say which way the.
I don't do that. I mean, in order to rule this out,
We don't have to do it. Then I think what Harvey said is right.
Well, let me just go on and I'll show you what on this looks. Let me show you how I'm thinking about analyzing this notion of causal influence. I mean, the intuitive idea is this is like the Q crisis advances. If you come in and you mess around over here and you change the detector setting, you can induce a change in this particle's properties. Okay. And what I'm examining now is the relativistic motivation for it. What I really want to say, is that relativity allows you unequivocally to say, well, almost unequivocally, barring any other physically significant events up here, we're going to assume that there's nothing else relevant going on. It's true that these four events here determine these two. Okay. Whether you can extract from that an interesting causal correlation between the detector setting and an individual particle property is, an importantly different question. So let me just say here, the detectors may have different settings at different points in the forward light cone. Look, I'm going to ignore this and grant that somehow the relevant setting is this one. All right, so this is already a bit problematic. If you notice how I've drawn this, if you look in the forward light cone, the forward light cone of the particle emission coincides over here with the point where the detector setting is changing. So if you somehow thought that the causal influence had something to do with, this is actually the kind of the way that Kramer and his transactional interpretation tends to take things. Of these things, detectors, for instance, is constantly emitting into the future and past little sort of indicator waves. I don't know what these words are, but these are indicator waves, but they sort of signal their presence. And he thinks of them as, I believe, traveling on a light cone. So if that's what you thought was relevant, something that's traveling on a light cone from the detector to the source, then your results are going to vary depending upon when you make this change. Okay, so if this was red, then the source would be prepared for a red detection, and then it's changed up here in blue detection. All right, so that's parenthetically. I think that's hugely problematic for that kind of model. So I'm going to grant that the relevant settings, for whatever reason, are going to be these, the ones at the time of detection.
But hold on, are you saying there's a deterministic causal relationship between those four data and what's happening at the source?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, what's that?
Okay, I just wanted to, because that seems to be a point way beyond the energy of relativity. Causality in the stochastic setting. I mean, it would be.
It is. And I think this is generalizable to the stochastic setting. I think the same points will emerge, but I'm doing a sort of relativistic deterministic kind of analysis. And I think that this is what the primitive backwards causal models that I've seen tend, I think, to work like that. In other words, there might be something hit, you may not be able to know the values of these, but once you have the values of all these properties at T1, at T equals 1, you get everything back. You get the particle positions in.
But even if you were thinking deterministically, there could be other, you could put in other variables,
mm-hmm.
and they would have effective random distribution, and they would help determine.
Right, you could basically have a noise field. You have some, not a noise field, but you have some sort of deterministic but unknown field here that's influencing things and giving things random kicks. Now, I don't think that that's going to help anybody model correlations. But anyway, you're right. My analysis is deterministic, the way I'm looking at this. So that's what the point of this is, that in relativistic theory, you can expect that these imply this in a stochastic relativistic theory. You would think that these imply this a variety of some probability distribution conditions.
So this is a kind of backward causation, but not one which will do the job. So I mean, this is really what's going on here is that the in a relativistic theory, deterministic relativistic theory anyway, you have determinism goes forward and backward in time. You can evolve a system forward, you can predict from initial conditions, and you can retrodict. Retrodiction is arguably a kind of backward causation, but it's not what people have in mind. And it won't do the job of bringing about a violation of the independence condition. So what proponents of backward causation want are final detector states, the detector states themselves to be correlated with the initial particle states. This could mean, as I say, one of two things. Could mean that holding the final particle states fixed, so L1 and R1, and changing the detector settings sometimes yields different initial particle states. This is the control of the detectors, in other words, implies some control over the initial state. In other words, the idea is that you can make a change in something that happened in the past by doing something now or something in the future. I can manipulate the detector and I can change the past. But the tacit demand in these analyses that the final state is determined by the initial state makes this impossible to satisfy, okay? Because what you have is L0 and L1 have to be, well, in any sort of Bell's theorem analysis, they are the same. Basically, this is just a particle property. It's a set of particle properties which determine outcomes. Okay, so it's impossible to hold this the same, change and mess around with this and change this, because by changing this, you would change this. So you're not holding it the same.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. Okay. So the other thing that it could mean is that the final detector states are correlated with the final particle states, and consequently with the initial particle states, that there's a correlation right at t equals 1, and that therefore there's also a correlation earlier. Different final detector settings are inevitably correlated with different final particle states. There's no causation here, however, okay? In other words, if you analyze causation as in this kind of counterfactual way, something is a cause if by leaving everything else fixed and changing the purported cause, I make a change in something in the past or the future. If you analyze causation that way, you don't have causation here. What you have is just this sort of built-in correlation between particle properties and detector settings up here. And then in virtue of that, you have a correlation between, so you have DL is correlated with these, and in virtue of that, it's also going to be correlated with L0, because by hypothesis, this isn't changing along the way. Yep.
This is all the level of intuition, or I'm not sure if this is just the level of motivation, but it seems clear that the words they want to use are neither of those, correspond to neither of those two alternatives that you gave us. What they want to say is that setting up the detector influences the initial position of the particle, and then by normal propagation, it propagated forward in time, and that influenced the later state of the particle. And therefore, a correlation arose between the final state detector and the final state of the particle.
Mm-hmm.
And you sort of ruled that out because you adopted some notion of causation where you set all the data at the final time on the Cauchy surface. And then it has to be seen as going one way into the past. So it's sort of pure backward, but they have in mind some sort of blend of forward and backward that I wouldn't know how to define myself. That
seems to be, that was the point of the question, but that's what they're aiming, that's their intuition. Right, so what I'm claiming, and not yet showing to your satisfaction, I think I can understand why, is that, that what they're trying to do just amounts to postulating non-local correlations between data at any given time, at least somehow. But that's what the independent assumption is. It has nothing to do with something, quote, propagating backward and then propagating back forward, which of course is kind of a dubious way to talk, right? Because the thing that's propagating backward is also something that is propagating forward. It's just two different descriptions of the same thing.
But this is the engine.
Yeah.
We can control the choice of settings in the apparatus. We can't control the invariables. So the point is that insofar as we can control the settings in the future,
mm-hmm.
those settings end up being correlated with the distribution in these states in the past. That's the assumption. And then
That's how Price thinks about his model, for instance, yeah. But the point is that you can't, if you want to analyze control as in a sort of counterfactual way, what I mean when I say that I can control something is if I had done something different, but everything else had been the same, the past would have been the same, that doesn't work. That's really the, I'd say the, that's the focus of my criticism of calling this causation, as opposed to mere correlation. It's a slogan. Correlation is not a causation.
But it seems to me, I mean, I see the point.
Yeah.
Given the amount of sort of ontology you adopted, there is no difference between the two statements. Mm-hmm. But they probably have in mind something more, you know, some advanced waves or something like that.
I was actually going to go over Price's model, but I think, and maybe I can after, during the discussion, if people want to, but I thought that was going to take up too much time for explaining. I mean, what you get, I think, out of his model is exactly this, what you get. You get something, if the model essentially proposes that events at one time are correlated in some non-standard way, are not freely specifiable in a way. Okay, so usually data on a space-like surface is freely specifiable, meaning the data at one point and the data at another point are independent. These models violate that. Now, one of the things I want to talk about at the end is a way to violate that sort of thing, in what you might call it, or still call it relativistic theory, kind of a non-local. Natural ways in which non-local correlations and violation of that free specifiability arise.
So you don't think it's not something like sort of Wheeler Feynman thing or supported?
That's one
there
way
is a,
to do.
There is a kind of
that's one way
equity causation.
Oh, no, 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 you mean the former theory, not this, because there's so many Wheeler ideas. I was thinking of the one with the electrons there. You know, there's only one electron.
No, this electromagnetic.
Yeah, that's what Kramer bases his idea on. Kramer is inspired by the Wheeler-Feynman theory, but I think that his that model is really, I don't even think it's a model. He called it an interpretation. There's no way it's an actual interpretation. It's a suggestion of a model which doesn't really make any sense. He essentially uses the wave function as a kind of an analogy to the electromagnetic waves. I mean, one of the funniest things about that model is that the Wheeler-Feynman theory, at the end of the day, got rid of the fields entirely. Like, you end up just at the field that aren't independent degrees of freedom, and well, you have resources. That's going to definitely take us too far afield. Confused discussion, confused theory. I've got to get back on this track. So,
okay, so this is what I'm claiming. Now, I think the most compelling way to motivate this backward causation idea is to think about the possibility that the detectors are emitting particles into the past, and the particle properties depend on the orientation of the detector. I mean, after all, we think this typically about events going into the future. If I have a pair of particle detectors and they're emitting particles, and they have different settings on the detectors, I might well, or not detectors, they're not going to be detectors now, these are sources, particle sources. I might well think that the properties of what's coming out of them are correlated with the things they're coming out of. Okay, I think that's the most plausible motivation for this, what you might call the backward causation idea. And regardless of whether you call it a backward causation, it's a motivation for thinking that the initial state lambda, L0, R0, is that this initial state is correlated with the detector. So in other words, if you flip this thing upside down, then it looks like you have some sort of, this is an energy source maybe, and this is something which emits particles. Particles are emitted, and no surprise that the particle properties are correlated, would be correlated with the detector settings. So, my reply to this is that this is a plausible way in which the independence assumption is going to be, might be violated. A reason to think that the assumption that goes into the Bell CHSH inequality is too strong. But in order to reproduce the observed quantum statistics, one needs correlations between L1 and R1 as well. In other words, it's what you need to do is produce, you don't just need correlations between particles and the detectors they're coming out of. You need correlations between the outcomes at the two detectors. That's what you're trying to use. So you have the two detectors are have the same orientation, have the same setting, and they have the same outcome. So the outcome is just a function of the state going in or coming out, depending on which temporal orientation you maintain, and the detector setting. So what you need are, again, are correlations between the data. You need, in other words, in order to get the quantum states, which you're going to, the quantum statistics, you're going to need correlations not only between DL1 and L1 slash L0, but also between L1 and R1 as well, L1 and L0 and R0 as a result. So again, what you're going to have is a kind of conspiracy theory. One interesting way to sort of reconceive this thing is to ask yourself, I'm not going to explore this in any great depth, about what, if any, what is puzzling if you look at an EPR experiment in reverse. Okay, what's going to be weird about that? And many things are going to be weird. It depends, but among other things, what you have is you have, let's say you have flashing lights as the detection events. So the time reverse of that is you have a bunch of correlated radiation coming in from various points in the future, converging on these detectors and caused at exactly the same time. Well, not necessarily exactly at the same time. It depends on how you do this experiment. But causing the emissions of emission of particles in such a way that they meet up at one particular source point. So what you do is you have this kind of, well, some people would call it a conspiracy. Some people would call it a very strange correlation. All right. I think that this is a, there are many subtleties to, I think it's an interesting exercise. I think it's a, there are many subtleties to analyzing it, however, because if you really ask what you would see if you looked at something like that, you might see nothing, okay, because you're not seeing the, you have radiation converging. You're not seeing anything flash anymore. You're having some sort of heat come in, perhaps, and give rise to a an emission of a pair of invisible particles, which at some point in the future maybe cause somebody's finger to be pushed off a switch. In any case, I think that this is the worst thing that's most worth thinking about anyway. This is the best case for backward causation, that somehow we're perfectly happy to think about particles being correlated with the things which emit them, okay? So that the laser pointer is, the color of this is highly correlated with the device which is generating it. And therefore, we have a plausible reason to violate the independence assumption. But I think that violating that independence assumption by itself is not going to, you need to add more in order to reproduce quantum statistics.
to complete the link?
Yeah, it is, but then you have, the problem is that since D, if it's fully deterministic, you have the detector here, over here, causing this, and this is correlated with this. It's the detector here correlates to this particle, detector here correlates to this particle, and then we're demanding a further correlation here, which is going to impose a constraint, a correlation on the final detector settings. And if you have that, then you're going to be, this is a good point, you're going to be hard pressed to say that you can freely choose the detector setting. Okay, if you have any, so somebody's already made their choice over here. Actually, this is part of what Price's model ends up looking like. What you think of as a free choice is not entirely or at all, I haven't really thought about how this all plays out statistically, free. Because if you end up in supposing that there's a correlation between, a plausible correlation between L0 and R0, because they're right there together, you end up imposing a correlation on the final detector choice of settings.
But how can that, couldn't you freely, I don't know, it's confusing, as you said, but couldn't you freely choose the final detector setting? And then they imply a particular probability distribution for L1 and R1, which is the right one. And then you just propagate that back, and that gives L0 and R0. But you haven't built in any correlation between B1.
Right, but then what you've then done is you sort of constrained the person who's supposed to be manipulating the other detector.
No, I let them both be free. So let the independent variables be DL1 and DL1.
Well, I think what's going to happen is that that you're going to screw up your attempt to get the statistics by building in the correlation you can't have at all. You can't have L0 and R0 cooperate to yield the intended correlations while also having free choice of both DL and DR.
I don't see why not.
I think what these models end up amounting to are they're models where, I mean, everybody's played this game before, but where's the chalk? They're models where you try to send, you know, a signal and convey information over here by staying along the light cone. You go back here and you go forward. Okay? I think that's what these kinds of, and what you end up really doing when you're doing something like this is you're postulating some sort of non-trivial correlation. Well, some sort of correlation between these two points. That's an intuitive this is helpful too. If it's not, you can ignore it. But this is what I would claim, is that you can't have free specifiability of both detectors and build in these kind of correlations between the detectors and the particles, and then hope to get out the quantum statistics. I think maybe this needs to be formally shown, but that's the intuition. Okay. And I should say that in the literature on this, there's a small literature on this. There's a paper by I think Clauser, Horn, and Shimoni, 85, talking about this loophole. There's
maybe it wasn't in 85. I think Bell's response to it was in 85. And then one of the last papers Bell wrote was called La Nouvelle Cuisine, in which he revisits this. And there's a tendency by these authors to read backward causation theories as conspiracy, what they call conspiracy theories. Okay, that somehow the past is already set up in a way so as to generate the quantum correlations. In a more or less classical way, but the idea is that there are some special initial conditions which get the thing done. Okay, such that everything comes out right, even though let me not sort of try to explicate their discussion further. But it's not, these two things have been discussed together. So what I want to talk about is, as I say, a lot of times when people, these things are almost always criticized as being conspiracy theories, okay, that backwards causation models end up effectively supposing some sort of cosmic conspiracy whereby quantum, the outcomes of experiments on quantum mechanics, on, that begs the question, on physical systems, look quantum mechanical and have these funny non-local correlations just because things are set up in a very particular way, okay? And in particular, that the data are not freely specifiable at every point in space. So I want to give two ways in which you can build models in which the data are not freely specifiable at every point in space. So this is just supposed to be a 1 plus 1 dimensional space-time, excuse me, compactified in the time direction, the cylinder. You can't arbitrarily specify the initial state of a single particle. So this is impossible. You can't have a particle that, I mean, this is modulo various conservation principles, which might fail, right? But if we think that a particle is not acted on by a force, is going to keep going in a straight line, this particle, you can't have this, because this is going to come and wrap around the back of the cylinder and come back up. And what you'll get is something like this. In fact, the only way you can have one particle in a world like this is if it's at rest in the preferred frame, okay? So it wraps around and wraps right onto itself instead of barber poling like this one does. Okay? So in a world like this, you would have data, you would find experimentally, if you could do experiments, that the data at an initial time was couldn't be regarded as freely specifiable. I'm in no way claiming that this simple model is going to reproduce any quantum correlations. But it's an interesting thing to think about. I think it's also interesting for the purpose of doing cosmology. It's a completely different context from what we're talking about there. If you're worried about why certain initial conditions might be privileged, this is the kind of thing that would introduces at least a constraint on the space of initial conditions. This is nothing like an interesting cosmological model, but so this is one sort of a very simple way to get what is a kind of non-local constraint. And notice that here, you really can't think about an intervention here is going to have, we have to think about what you mean by an intervention, but you can't change something here without changing things everywhere else, even though this isn't, might in some sense be a local theory. So this is another, or the other example that I wanted to just introduce. This comes from thinking about time-like initial data for the wave equation, box phi equals zero, sort of the simplest relativistic equation you can imagine. This is 2 plus 1. That's x coming out of the gray sheet. That's y, and t is vertical. And this is the usual domain of dependence for E. But region R here, this is a thin ellipse in the YT plane, is also a domain of dependence for E. In that, if you give data here, you've uniquely determined the value of the field at E. This is a result which is, as I think John Stachel put it, well known to those who know it, to about 25 people. It's actually in Fritz John's textbook. This is a consequence of the Holmgren-John uniqueness theorem. So data in R uniquely determines E. But data in the red region here, so what I've done is dictated by data in the blue region. So in other words, this is now looking at just a piece of that gray sheet. This is Y, this is T. No, it isn't. It's in fact, no, it's all trivial in 1+1 dimension. Right. Yeah. No, this is, okay, this result, I don't know where the change ended up. So this is a result for any data on any time-like surface for the wave equation. It's not a result for characteristic surfaces, but time-like surfaces. And it's also a result for the analogs of this, of the ultra-hyperbolic equation with more than one time dimension. So it's a wave equation with a couple of, more than one time. So if you have more than one time, then any initial data surface, any surface of codimension one, is necessarily going to be extended in space and time, because you have all those extra times lying around. And you get a dependency result like this. So you do have existence. Well, you don't get, what you have is unique development of initial data. What you don't have is existence in the sense of arbitrarily specifiable. Arbitrary data on this surface does not yield a well-defined evolution. Okay, arbitrary data on a space-like surface does. Here, you don't have it, and that's the point of this. Okay, so for instance, this is a result that's actually sitting in the back of Courant and Hilbert, volume 2. This is the data in here determines the data in this region. These are null rays extending from the ends of the ellipse. Okay, so data on one of those sheets is not freely specifiable. And you might fancifully imagine that quantum correlations come out somehow this way, that maybe quantum mechanics is a theory of a world with multiple times, which is sort of projected into a single time, and you're finding that the data on the initial surface at a single, so in other words, what we think of as a space-like surface is actually a surface that has a kind of a hidden, maybe it's not hidden, time dimension associated with it, in which case, if you had an equation like this, you would have non-trivial constraints on the initial data. So I present this, I mean, it's very interesting to think about from the standpoint of causality. And it's also just a useful way to kind of, I think, stretch the mind to think about where quantum correlations could come from. I should also add that if you think hard about why it is that you can't use this phenomenon to, say, send signals from here to here, you reach the conclusion that this has something to do with the fact that the data is not freely specifiable. And in order to, it's very much like the analysis I was giving of causality before, that if you want to be able to, if to think about causality, you need to be able to, at least in your mind, change one thing while holding everything else fixed. Okay? But here, you can't do that. You can't imagine, you can't calculate the effects of a small perturbation here. Okay? Because a small perturbation here is likely to be associated with a completely different set of data on the whole thing. You can't just take the little, make a change here and hold everything else fixed and hope to have a solution to the equation at all. Okay? So that's a bit of a motivation for the analysis of causality that I gave. All right. Okay, conclusion. 1:05. This is a strangely on-time talk. Okay, so motivation for the possibility of the failure of the independence assumption has largely been derived by others from the perceived possibility of backward causation, but I've argued that backward causation is a misnomer, that it's not really causation. Backward causation models essentially presuppose a non-causal correlation between spatially separated variables. And non-causal correlations of this general sort are shown to be predictions of models with closed time-like curves and models with extra time dimensions. And I think these are, they're not obviously not directly applicable to reproducing the predictions of quantum mechanics. It's not just to pick the right geometry and topology of space-time that you'll suddenly find that the constraints on the initial data are such as to reproduce quantum correlations. But I think that they're good sort of directions in which to look. And I think, in particular, that sort of junking the actual insight behind this backward causation model, with the insight is that there's non-local correlations and sort of throwing these ideas in this basket called conspiracy theories, because conspiracy theories just sounds, you know, by design, kind of loony, right? Well, who's going to believe a conspiracy theory? I think that that's premature, and I think there's lots of interesting avenues to explore. So that's it.
Would it also be a misnomer to call backward causation simply action at a distance, or is there something really different between backward causation and action at a distance?
Well, I think action at a distance can mean sometimes action at a distance means maybe this is what you mean. Action without intervening field. So the Wheeler-Feynman absorber theory is called an action at a distance theory. Now, things happen along like problems. If I jiggle the charge here, this charge jiggles as a result much later. But there's no field propagating the interaction. Is that what you're thinking of or not?
Not that. I wasn't thinking that specifically.
Okay.
I just mean this backward causation where you have, say, some causation going back in time and then some causation going forward in time, so you can get two space-like events correlated,
mm-hmm.
is equivalent to saying, well, I could draw my causation path like that along the space-like surface.
Right, but I don't want to call that causation, because I think there's a difference between non-local correlation and what we think of as causation. And I also think, I mean, it leads you into great difficulties if you think about things going backward and forward in time. I mean, this is Kramer's language. The framework of the transactional interpretation thing, and he sometimes disclaims it, right? He says, I know this is just a figure of speech, but I think it really sort of underestimates how problematic it is. I mean, a light ray propagating through the universe, and so a plane wave propagating through an empty universe is not going forward or backward, it's just there.
Yeah.
You know, from one perspective, it might be going forward, then back. So. And so you're just suggesting though, that this is really that kind of thinking is best thought of as one that presupposes
yes,
non-trivial correlations. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because there's no sense in talking about going back.
Right. Right. Sure. Good.
You had these two, or three diagrams a few transparencies ago with various different sort of dimension dependence. So by thinking about this kind of, and also there was, yeah, that's right, this one, and but this kind of, by thinking in terms of this kind of considerations, mm-hmm. could you just from sort of looking at how things depend on other things, find a way of saying whether a particular interval is space-like or time-like? Because it looks like there's a difference between the way in which E depends on R and the way in which it depends on the black region, in that R isn't freely specified, but rather the wider region around R isn't freely specified. So it looks like this is giving you some way to say that the time coordinate is playing a different role to the space coordinate. Mm-hmm. Can you say more about that?
Yeah, well, I agree. You the difference between time and space. So you might think, well, okay, I have determinism in both directions. I can go, I evolve deterministically from this time-like surface, which is a surface that's extended, has one time-like direction. I can evolve like this, or I can evolve like this. So what makes one time? And then what you might say is, well, I can specify data freely at this quote space-like surface, but I can't do it on the time-like surface. It's highly constrained. So I think that's a big plausible way. I think it's related to what Craig Callender has a paper on this, when he's exploring this issue, what's the difference between space and time. And he looked at multiple time dimensions. This is sort of the thing that he fell back on. Now, I think it's a little bit more subtle than that, but there certainly is a difference. And you know, this ellipse can be as thin as you want. It's really quite an interesting, strange result. But whereas this is a whole, you know, slice of the back of light.
I'm sure there's no analyticity assumption at all.
Yeah, the Holmgren theorem makes an analyticity assumption, and I think that what John added was that you drop the analyticity.
So there's not a form of it where you assume no analyticity?
There is a form of it.
You
don't assume no analyticity as a solution. That's right. That doesn't play any role, ultimately. Especially in this, actually, this result, I have no idea what I'm doing. This bit, which is in the back of Corinne and Hilbert, this sort of dependency just comes out of as Geierson's mean value theorem. So the fact that this data depends on this, and actually they get something that looks pretty close. So we get in the back of Corinne and Hilbert, they derive something that basically looks this result.
That's what a special case is.
What is that?
Why isn't this a special case of the original rule diagram? Corinne and Hilbert.
Well,
So they already proved it without an analyticity assumption.
Now I'm trying to remember, there's something additional that the Holmgren theorem. Yeah, well, it's a special case you're thinking, because if you flip this ellipse around and you can extend off the surface, you've got the ellipse that's living in the xt plane here, and you can get E. Right. Anyway, without trying to remind myself of all that, I just want to say that at Corinne and Hilbert, when they're discussing this result, which is actually done in the form of a cylinder, not an ellipse. So they have this sort of a finite cylinder of radius epsilon. And then they point out that, or they demonstrate the value of the field in there determines uniquely the value of the field out here. As this is replaced with a thin cylinder. They remark on the fact that no analyticity is assumed. and that it's special and surprising as a result. So I should also add that this implies it's in the world, you know, determined by the governed by the wave equation. It implies that if you have a basically data in an infinitesimal region for all times, but not all lines, based on you determine that it determines the solution everywhere. So it's kind of a interesting. Yes.
So granting that you're restricting this to deterministic models. Now, deterministic model means if you know everything at one time, you can predict either before or after. Mm-hmm. And you went from that to saying that if you know the two outcomes and the two settings, that's everything. So you must be able to predict what happened earlier. But that is right. That statement assumes there are no hidden variables. Because a deterministic model with hidden variables, you would have to know the hidden variables to make it predictive.
Yeah.
So if there are hidden variables, which is what the whole premise of these approaches are, then those four pieces of information are not enough to back up and find out what happened earlier.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, let's see. In general, I agree with what you're saying. Usually the lambda, which is the L0 and the L0, L1, R0, R1, are thought of as parameterizing the variables. So you're saying that maybe there is something else in addition to what I'm calling a particle with a certain property. There might be some other particles around that are really part of whether or not you want to call them part of lambda that have other properties that are influencing how the thing goes. There is an analysis like this in, it's in here, I think, Bell's article on, I was just looking at it earlier today, in which he, so Bell takes that point of view, and in addition to lambda, he also considers other variables, which he calls C. And does an analysis in terms of that. I wanted to kind of keep this simple. Is your sense that there'd be anything interesting?
Yeah, sure. Even if you know those four pieces of information, it doesn't mean you know the hidden variables.
No, I agree. And but so the question is what can you do if you throw in some extra? I mean, the thing is that the piece of information L0 is, or L1 is not necessarily a single piece, it could be a whole stream of information. So. My sense is that I haven't, the generality of this claim is not really impaired all that much. That L0 and R0 together encompass any other factors within the forward and backward light cone that might be thought to affect the outcomes. Now, there are other factors, they're not necessarily going to be representable by a trajectory of a single particle in that respect. This, the graphics are misleading. But I'd be interested to, you know, to hear about any other loopholes perceived or otherwise. Yes?
Yeah. I was a bit confused about the conclusion. Can you go back to the conclusion?
Right.
So just the thing about the you objecting to the word, objecting to calling these things
backward causation.
Oh, and the other one to call them conspiracy plots. Did you object to sort of identifying the two things together, or just the word?
It's the word conspiracy. I mean, the word conspiracy seemed basically to suggest throwing in the towel on explaining the conspiracy. I mean, in other words, if you could call any physical law a conspiracy in nature, but if you have some sort of physical law as a general principle which explains a lot of a common pattern that you find everywhere, and quantum mechanics, in some sense, is a common patterns of mind everywhere. And if you found something to explain these correlations, some general principle, we would call it conspiracy.
But it just depends on which way you're thinking about time going.
in this pitch. I mean, you call it backward causation if you're thinking, well, the setting I'm putting on now is affecting the state of this particle as it goes back into the past. Or you say, well, the particle's coming out of the past and somehow I'm forced to make this decision. How strange, if you look at it the other way. So if there's nothing to, the two things are essentially equivalent, if there's nothing to distinguish the two directions in time, if you haven't made any special assumption about what's causing what. In one picture, the particle is causing you to pick a certain setting, and that looks sort of conspiratorial. In the other way around, the setting's causing the particle to do something, but really it's just the correlation you're interested in. If you hadn't said anything special about what you think is causing it, if you hadn't given any special meaning to something causing something else, apart from the correlation.
Right. I mean, you said the state of the particle is causing you to... See, I think if this is, because I don't really think that there is any sensible temporal order to be given to this, I think that these models basically presuppose correlations on all levels. So the other way that people have read conspiracy theories, like, it's actually a pretty funny exchange between Shimini and Bell about whether or not, they think that this kind of model undermines our ability to think of ourselves as freely specified. So our actions are not free, they're determined. So somehow this particle is either, you could say, determining what we do, but it's really, I think, the perspective I'm offering is that it's correlated with what we do. It doesn't cause us. It's not as if the particle had done something different and we were the same, then we would have been forced to choose something different.
Well, the conspiratorial aspect of it is just that choose to set that setting depending on, I don't know, the color of a distant star or the lottery result of that date still. Yeah. Somehow it'll just all work out so that it was still correlated in that way. So.
Right.
And it just, but then if you describe it as backward causation, it doesn't sound so crazy. Because you say, well,
But the problem with backward causation, right, and this is something that, you know, philosophers and many people have gotten up on, there's really backward causation. How come I can't change the past? You know, the grandfather paradox. And actually, this is the sort of worry that people have with models with closed time-like curves, right? You know, people get very exercised about these sorts of things.
This makes me wonder, just speaking at the, general philosophical level, whether at least Hugh Price, I don't know about the rest of them, but whether Hugh himself would be bothered by this. And the reason I say this is because I know Hugh's philosophy more than I know his physics. And philosophically, though he is very pragmatist about theories of meaning and theories of truth, so he sort of follows the kind of line of James and Dewey and those guys, he parts from them in that he's quite a fan of block universes. So for Hugh, the universe just is. There's nothing happening there. There's no good notion of time in there. The universe just is. It's just a big block. And when he analyzes the idea of causation, he always introduces an agent.
Right.
Just like he, when he analyzes probability, he introduces an agent. And if one asks, well, what is probability without an agent in the background, he'd say, well, it has no meaning. And similarly, if one asks, what is causation without someone imagining the possibility of jiggling this way or jiggling that way, Hugh, as I understand him, would say, well, it has no meaning. These are subjective terms. So for him, the universe just is. I mean, you can call this non-local correlation, but it's just, you know, there's just one universe stamped out by God in God's mind or something, and that's it. And all of this talk about causation, forward causation, backward causation, and so forth, only comes about when we're imagining some kind of experimenter in the picture. But it's not a statement of how things really are.
Right.
I just wonder whether he would say, yeah, great, thanks, you understood the point.
you're right that he thinks that the direction, that there's an inherently perspectival notion to
causation.
Thank you. And that part of the way he gets what he calls retro causation, he distinguishes this from backward causation, is that he thinks that if you you conceive of yourself as what it has to do with what you think of yourself as being able to freely specify. So Hume thinks that you can freely specify this, and you can freely specify this up here, then you can make sense of this as the thing being caused. And, you know, my quarrel with that is in part that I don't think that this is really is any useful sense in which this is, in his model, that there's anything sort of going on into the past. And in particular, he thinks that, you know, this is freely specifiable, whereas this isn't. You know, I think this interacts with freely specifiable.
Well, why can't it be the hidden variables that are caused?
Well, it depends what you mean by what Hume thinks the hidden variables are. And this, I'm just talking about his model and his way of thinking, because it's, he thinks of these, the particles themselves, as hidden. Those are things about which we don't see and which we don't have any control over. What we see are detectors and outcomes, and we see somebody pushing a button down here. And that's his way of thinking. And this is sort of dovetails with, I think, the original Bell analyses, whereas these are, you know, there aren't really any particles in the picture. There's just some state parameterized by this, by lambda, or some family of states, which one way or the other, whatever they are, when the particles are little, you know, it fields give rise stochastically or deterministically, depending on which paper you're looking at, to the outcomes of the wings. That's the original picture, and that's sort of where he comes from. And then he calls it retrocausation because he thinks that if you think of yourself, and he does say that there's this
perfect. If you think of yourself up there.
Right. You know, whether or not causation is real, he thinks that this has some explanatory power. He's advancing it. He's been sort of urging this as a way to come up with an understanding of what's really going on in the block universe. And I think there is something to it, but I think that really what it amounts to is all I'm really urging is that there's, like, it's not best thought of in terms of backward causation. It's best thought of in terms of some people call it conspiracy, but about non-local, interesting non-local correlations. And it's really, it is interesting, by the way, to think about what, in terms of free specifiability, about what you can specify freely on an initial surface of quantum mechanics. And mainly what you can't specify, you can specify the values of a field or a particle position, but you can't specify those and their time derivatives. That's the, for the momentum related to the time derivatives, the Fourier transform is really the constraint. And that's actually very different from the problem that I put up there before with the kind of the data on a time-like surface for the wave equation. There are independent constraints for the data and its normal derivative, the way that the phi dot, those are both constrained independently. They don't have sort of a usual mutuality. Any other questions? Okay.
Yeah, you indicate, well, in general comment, it seems to me what this is saying is that there might be a place there for an interesting kind of theory, but everything depends on whether a concrete realization of something. Mm-hmm. You indicated two ways you might get it. One would be by closed, having some sort of closed causal curves. The other one was a second time direction.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't understand that. What did you have something definite in mind? I don't even know what it means. Is it like a Kluge-Klein dimension with an extra, which is time-like, or what did you mean by a second time-like, an extra time-like direction? And I didn't, since I didn't understand what you meant by it, I also
well,
and how it would give rise to
right. Fair enough. I don't know how it's going to get. The idea for it really is that you might imagine that what we call a space-like surface is a space-time surface. It's a surface that has, so one way to think about this is our universe has two times of three space, two time dimensions and three spatial dimensions. One of the time dimensions is the one we ordinarily see. The other one is, you know, it's hidden or it's invisible to us because of the kind of people we are. Maybe we live in a kind of a projection.
It's like a Kaluza Klein.
Well, it's a Kaluza Klein if you compactify it.
Okay, the original Kaluza thing.
Okay, all right. Then it's like a Kaluza Klein.
So by Kaluza Klein, you mean extra?
What?
By Kaluza Klein, you mean extra?
Extra and open.
By Kaluza Klein, I mean that you identify us with the kind of quotient of.
Yeah. Right. That's one way to do it. I mean, so if that were the case, then you would have.
Restart the thing.
There's a way to get rid of that. You just drag that thing off to the corner and it just sits there. And
I know, it's working. I'm really interested in it.
It'll come up. It's just sit there. Don't say later, just tell the answer. And drag it off to the corner.
My machine insists that we'll restart in, 3 minutes and don't do anything. So you're right.
Oh, good.
All right. Yeah. Anyway, yes. So I suppose
it's
a bit exposed.
It just didn't under that.
Okay, turn it off. So anyway, that's about what I was thinking.
And then therefore you would have. Because your data would now be on a primary timeline.
Well, it's just a way to get, data on, right, you would have data that's not
So we could have a small, compact, time-like dimension.
Good. But then, if you have a compact time-like dimension, then you have both of those. Most of them, I think.
Yeah. That's good.
Sure. I mean, I think the thing to do is to sort of, you can play with these examples, but you really have to figure out what you're trying to get.
And if you only have time direction, it's not convective at all. Is it true that the data is not really specified by what we would call a space-like surface?
If you have an extra time-like dimension, then physics isn't a Cauchy problem on space-like slices. You're underdetermined, I think.
It may be underdetermined, but that's different. But the question is, what you want is something where you're not allowed to truly specify data on what you took to be the Cauchy surface. I'm not sure. But you're saying it might be the case.
Well, I mean, I'll tell you
the case that you're not.
Which scenario are you thinking?
Well, your second scenario. You do objective putting close.
Right, so you make it
because that brings in the first scenario. So that's just a non-contact.
Extra time. Yeah.
Does it then follow that there's some constraint on initial data?
Yes.
On what we take to be a Cauchy surface. I mean, of course, in the higher dimensional sense, there's a constraint, but we don't see that.
Would
either be on a section or it would be some data that's just independent of the extra time.
Oh, I see what you mean. It's if this is your surface, this is the extra time and this is space, and you just wanted to pick data on this strip, one line, would that data be constrained along here?
Yeah.
I think so, but I'm not sure. I mean, the really difficult thing is to figure out. It's difficult to figure out how. So, what I've been working on with a collaborator was trying to figure out the nature of the constraint on this. So, it's generally thought this is not a well-posed problem because, for the reason I said, you can't specify data arbitrarily, but you can't write down.
I'm pretty sure it's not well-posed in some technical sense, which requires some continuity of the
You can make it well-posed if you impose a constraint on the space of initial data
No, even then,
no, but he, well.
It isn't dependent.
What? Yeah.
That there's a continuous dependence of fetal value.
Yes, if you restrict yourself to working with data that satisfies the constraints, and you could use like you would in Maxwell theory, you know, constraints of the initial data.
Yeah.
And in other words, you can't specify arbitrary initial data for the electromagnetic field that both to satisfy Maxwell's equations.
Right.
It has to satisfy the Gauss law, the, whatever that other law is called, if B equals zero. So similarly, you can write down a constraint here, but it's a different sort of constraint. It's not a local constraint like div b equals zero or div b equals zero. And it's most simply expressed in terms of the Fourier coefficient, in terms of the k's, not the x's. The whole thing is incredibly non-local, so you can get a space of data, you can consider small perturbations of that data within that space and show that they don't blow up, okay, that they don't diverge, that the solution is appropriately stable. In particular norm, yeah. But it's, there's no intuitive way to sort of to visualize what it looks like, what that space of data looks like in X space. So therefore, I'm not quite sure what it means, what the data, what the constraints on a particular line in this look like, which is what we were just talking about. There might be something to say.
This is 5:30, we should probably.
Sure.
Well, hi, I'm going to do that. Thanks, Steve. If anyone wants to give a talk this semester, just send me a note, the title.